Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 26th through July 6th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only, some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
All right, welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am just delightful. Delighted. No, I'm not delightful. I'm delighted.
Maybe Alyssa, you are delightful. And I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
Thank you to everyone who's listening to This Tuesday for helping keep this thing afloat. Make sure you go back and listen to the Widow's Bay episode. We were just discussing it. That dropped on Saturday. What's interesting about when you run a website and you look at analytics, specifically newsletter websites, you can see which emails get open and which don't. And like an ironclad law of newsletter writing is that weekend newsletters get open less frequently because folks just aren't like sitting on their inboxes. You know, they're not sitting on their laptops at work working, waiting for their podcast episodes to drop. So anyway, go back and check it. You got some content there for you. Go listen to the content. And now on to controversies and non-troversies, where we find that MGM Amazon has made the surprising decision late last week to dump its upcoming film about OpenAI's Sam Altman, which is directed by Luca Guadagnino, after seeing a rough cut of the film. Matt Bellany had the news late last week, early this weekend. I don't know, sometime. So it broke last week, reporting that the film Artificial, which is nearly finished and cost roughly $40 million to produce, is being shopped to other distributors because the tone of the film has shifted somewhat since the script was picked up. Here's what an Amazon rep told Bellany, quote, "We have the utmost respect and admiration for Luca Guadagnino as an award-winning filmmaker, not to mention a long-standing relationship that we hope to continue. We believe that Artificial will be better served if it were released by a different studio and are working closely with the filmmaking team to find the film a new home," end quote. As Bellany sardonically put it after that letter, okay. The obvious read here is that Amazon is dumping the film, right? The script of which was pretty nakedly antagonistic to Altman, according to those who have read it. I've not read it. I'm just going on reports. Antagonistic to the effort to take OpenAI private, right? They don't want to aggravate a powerful player in the AI space who they have invested heavily with and who is friendly with the Trump White House. Amazon MGM, of course, kind of flipping the script here, spent $75 million on the Brett Ratner film Melania, which grossed $16 million worldwide in theaters. A more charitable reading of what's happening here. Let's be charitable here. We're charitable on this show. A more charitable reading is that Guadagnino has released a string of movies that have had, let's say, middling box office returns. And Amazon didn't want to throw good money after bad, right? Okay, so his Suspiria remake grossed just $8 million worldwide, though it only cost $20 million to make. Bones and All grossed just $15 million on a similar budget. Challengers did okay business. It hit nearly $100 million, though it cost $55 million to make after marketing and the cut that theaters take. That movie was probably still in the red as well. After the Hunt, a disaster. That was a disaster. It cost $70 million and it grossed less than $10 million. While his Daniel Craig movie, Queer, grossed just $7 million and cost nearly $50 million. A movie about Sam Altman does not strike me as particularly likely to break that streak. A third angle here is that Amazon MGM's own commitment to theatrical is not totally secure. Yes, Project Hail Mary was an enormous hit, but its grosses will be subsidizing the losses sustained by the disastrous Masters of the Universe. And Amazon recently announced that its Voltron film will premiere directly on Prime Video. So nobody seems to be jumping at the chance to distribute this thing, right? Artificial has been screened by indie-minded and, you know, kind of studio sublabels like Focus, the new WB label Clockwork, A24, Netflix. They've all passed. Variety reports that MUBI and Neon are potentially interested. We'll see. We'll have to wait and see, right? If they if it winds up somewhere else or if it just gets killed for a tax write-off by Amazon. But Alyssa, doesn't this just kind of confirm our fears about AI and big tech using their enormous power and deep pocketbooks to silence all potential criticism?
There's a phrase that I'm curious about in that statement that you read, which is better served. And I would be very curious as to whether OpenAI's deal with Amazon has any restrictions on their ability to produce content, produce or market content about the company specifically, artificial intelligence generally. I have no way of knowing if something like that is in there, but the better served line is interesting. And I wonder if it suggests that there were either actual restrictions on what Amazon and Jam was able to do, or if it's just a polite way of saying, like, we can't get this thing over the finish line, maybe someone else can. You know, I think all three of us are somewhat outliers in that, I mean, I haven't seen Bones and All, but I liked After the Hunt quite a bit. I really love Challengers, really like Call Me By Your Name.
I think we're like the only movie critics who liked After the Hunt. I'm actually, I'm not even entirely kidding. I'm a little bit, but I'm struggling to think of another critic outside of our podcast who liked After the Hunt. And certainly we all thought it was like quite good. It's not just that we thought, oh, this is not bad. We thought it was quite good.
Yeah. And so I am both quite concerned about this as a precedent, especially because it's just like, it's pretty clear that Amazon is on some level willing to do this. Like, they're willing to play ball on some level. And if there was any filmmaker this was going to happen to, this wouldn't shock me, right? Like, the budgets on a bunch of these movies are pretty high, right? I mean, they're pretty high for what they are, right? And I have to imagine that a lot of that is star-driven casting, right? Like, I don't know what Julia Roberts' quote these days is, but, like, I have to imagine it's pretty high. You know, Zendaya clearly is earning a healthy amount of money, even if Challengers was made before Josh O'Connor was, you know, like, keep sort of hot priest in it all over various other movies. And so, yeah, I think it's a situation where it is much more likely to be both and rather than either or. Just because I think that, yeah, I think Amazon clearly seems pretty comfortable playing ball with the administration and with, you know, sort of, or just playing ball in general, right? I mean, like, I don't think they went into original content to get people to spend more time on Amazon as a platform to make the Prime subscription more valuable. You know, they've had good people working in that division, but I don't think, like, Amazon as a company is, you know, sort of really spiritually devoted to making great art. It's a way to get people to buy more toilet paper. And, you know, it's a company that is interested in getting people to buy more toilet paper, but also, like, you know, in making sure that it doesn't get cut off from, like, big government contracts for Amazon Web Services. It's just like, It is not a corporate environment that is set up to prioritize the making and championing of great art. And look, like, television and programming exists to sell soap. Like, this is not, that tension between art and commerce is not new. But I do think the idea that there is a government willingness to use commerce as a way to stifle or manifest the creation of certain kinds of art is newer. And I think Amazon just feels a little bit more willing. Like, we haven't seen a situation where, like, Apple necessarily is going to knuckle under. But I also think that Apple as a company seems like a little bit more invested in, you know, doing some sort of high-end stuff. They also have just this, like, vast boat of cash that they're sitting on. So I don't know. I mean, I personally like Luca Guadagnino movies, but I understand why this would be the kind of movie that people sort of felt like they could sacrifice in service of a business deal without people getting too upset about it. I also just like, I think it gets at some interesting questions of like, you know, there's some polling out from the folks at The Argument that suggests that like AI is just not really a politically salient issue for people yet. Like you're starting to see some emerging local politics around data centers. You know, you did see like an attack on one of Sam Altman's houses, but there's this sort of gap between the intensity of some of the debates about AI and sort of how the public actually seems to be feeling about AI. And if I were OpenAI, I would probably care a lot about trying to sort of keep it that way or, you know, pushing back against the idea that the person who's running our company is like just like sort of congenitally dishonest, which was an issue, you know, sort of a question that was at issue in the sort of the litigation between Elon Musk and OpenAI. And so there's still a lot of room for these companies and their CEOs to define public perceptions of themselves and whether they're good and whether regulating them should be a priority. And so I can see why this particular movie would be a priority for OpenAI, but not for Amazon.
Yeah, I think this goes back to my big complaint about a lot of what we're seeing out in the world right now, which is that like I can construct a case against making, releasing whatever this movie on purely financial grounds, right? Like I think you could very easily just be like, it's not gonna make money. We don't wanna lose more money. We've lost a lot of money on Luca Guadagnino already. The problem, as I see it, and this is like kind of a continuing thing, you see it in Paramount CBS, you see it elsewhere, is that all of the government interference and all of these various little things, the willingness of the administration to hurt its enemies and help its allies, just creates a lot of uncertainty and distrust about what we're seeing and who we're seeing it from.
So I'm just less concerned about this than you guys are. Sure, it really sucks if you are a filmmaker and you get most of the way through the process and then your backer distributor dumps you. That's going to be unpleasant for sure. On the other hand, there's a history of that sort of thing. I mean, just, you know, but not just in the world of movies, but also in novels, right? You look at something like American Psycho, where the publisher just dumped it right before it was released because it was crazy. I mean, we don't need to talk about some of the stuff that is in American Psycho. It is not appropriate for a podcast with Alyssa on it, I think, if nothing else, right?
I mean, but the book eventually came out. I've never watched American Psycho is because Christian Bale is like imprinted on me as Laurie Lawrence from Little Women.
I'm talking about the book, not the movie. And it was the book that was shot. Simon & Schuster was going to publish it. And Bret Easton Ellis got to keep his $300,000. But they said, we're not doing this. And this was like not long before publication was scheduled. But it eventually came out. And this is the thing about this deal. And this story is, it is likely, it's not guaranteed, but it is likely at this point that this movie will become available to see. Perhaps not in the ideal format, perhaps not, you know, with a great theatrical release and huge amount of publicity and marketing around it. But this movie is not being, as of today, as of this discussion, being buried in the way that, say, Batgirl was, right? In some ways, this looks, it's not exactly the same, but it looks a little bit like what happened with Larry Clark's movie Kids in the 1990s, where because of the NC-17 thing, the rating that was applied to it, Disney was like, we can't release this in this format. They created a shell company to release that instead, right? Just because of the content of it. But then the other way to look at this is it's something like how Bloomberg treats coverage of Michael Bloomberg. They have a publicly known editorial policy that they do not cover in any way, shape, or form Michael Bloomberg's personal wealth or business deals. And you can say, well, that's stupid, or they should, or whatever. But it's also like they're tremendously successful and profitable, and that makes sense. That's not their business. I mean, right? Like in some, like you could make an argument even that it is their business because they cover finance and et cetera. But it just like, there's no good way to, you either do it and like you're probably going to end up with critical coverage that your owner doesn't like, or you don't do it. And yeah, you're in this situation, but you can just run your business normally. And this, like, this just doesn't strike me as a completely like out of line, totally crazy thing for Amazon to say, look, we're in business with OpenAI, which means we're in business with Sam Altman. Therefore, we are not going to be the home for this. But what we're not going to do is just say this is buried. This is that nobody can see this. Somebody else is going to get this and it's going to come out. It's just not going to come out under our banner.
Can I ask you a question, Peter? Because I think this is something that I am struggling to define for myself a little bit. And that feels to me like it is kind of woven through a lot of our conversations. And forgive me if I'm summarizing this wrong, but I think obviously libertarians feel like there is a difference in degree and kind between state power and corporate power. But is there a point at which some corporations could become so large and influential that they start to be able to exert power sort of on the same level or magnitude as a state?
Yes. See, people have this view, and I really reject that. I'm sorry, go ahead. But like, I hear that all the time. And I hear that from you know, people sort of on on the left and even on the sort of, I would say this is a very common idea on a kind of progressive left, a sort of with the sort of, what do you want to call it? The neo-Brandeisian kind of Lena Khan types, who I just view as like deeply anti-libertarian, because my view is the government has the guns. They can put you in jail. Sam Altman and Elon Musk can't send guys to my house legally to pick me up and put me in jail in the way that Donald Trump can. And that's the big difference. They also can't wage war. And like Elon Musk, yes, we can argue about like, okay, does Elon Musk, does Jeff Bezos, do any of these guys, right? Like in some ways they're involved in the government and sometimes they're providing, I mean, you know, Palantir is providing targeting services. Does that make it different? It's, you know, kind of fundamentally an argument, like an arm of the government. And in some cases, perhaps that does, but like the dividing line is, do they have the power to send guys with guns to my house and throw me in jail? If not, then they're different than the government, like in a really significant, meaningful way, no matter how big they are, no matter how powerful they are otherwise.
Okay. All right. I feel like I didn't really get to finish asking that question, and like maybe it's not fruitful.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have interrupted. I feel like I've had this discussion so many times with so many people, and that's the clear dividing line. Okay. It's not size and scale.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm very sorry. I went too hard on that one.
Peter's view is that all government power is bad. And all corporate power is fine. That's the basic libertarian point. That's fine. It's fine.
Not fine. And I'm trying to back down and also to apologize here. Because I can just see like I went way too hard on that one with a friend, and I'm actually interested in where you were going with this and to have this discussion.
So I think all of us have read or at least seen some science fiction in which sort of corporations kind of take over for states, right? I mean, the Luna novels, Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy. You know, I've been thinking about this some in terms of, you know, Elon Musk's, you know, deployment or withdrawal of access to Starlink. Yes, I think obviously there are differences between, you know, the people who have the guns and the people who don't have the guns, but maybe have the ability to like shut off the targeting computers on the guns, right? Like, which is sort of the case with, you know, Starlink in Ukraine. But I guess my question is there a point at which corporate power starts to have an influence on what people can say and think in a way that is sort of deleterious to the public sphere? And like, I'm curious whether you think there are ways in which sort of the concentration of wealth or the power of a company like OpenAI to sort of shape reality does start to give it power that is worrisome from a, you know, from an individual liberties perspective in a way that's maybe distinct from the power of the government, right? I mean, I sent you guys a website over the weekend called In the Weights, sort of claims to measure sort of how influential information created, disseminated by individual people are in the sort of weighting of various AI. I'm like, we're all top 5%. Aren't we special human beings? Is there some third category here that you think is sort of, I don't know, that you could see becoming sort of worth grappling with? Again, obviously there are ways in which like very big companies have made my life a lot better. I don't sort of a priori have a problem with that. But I am curious about whether there would be a point at which you would like sort of setting aside the distinction between sort of corporate power and government power. Is there some sort of third space or like third level of impact that you would find worrying?
Maybe
the answer is no. I just don't know.
Answer is mostly no. Let me try to think through this, but let's start with mostly no, but let me see if I can come up with an answer that's not just mostly no. I think the concern, if I can sort of replay it back to you, that I hear a lot of the time in circumstances like this is that big corporations, for example, might be so powerful that they're suppressing speech, essentially, right? That you can't, and in some sense, you can't criticize them. And while it's certainly true that, a company like OpenAI and working with Amazon might not want a film made about them, or that Michael Bloomberg might not want his own company covering him, I don't think people have an inherent right to say, the journalists at Bloomberg don't have an inherent right to use Michael Bloomberg's resources to say stuff about him that he doesn't want said. And I think that's a fairly similar story here. And what I would worry about is if Michael Bloomberg became so powerful that literally no one anywhere could criticize him. If it were simply not possible to publish on the web or on a podcast or on YouTube or whatever, criticism of Michael Bloomberg. Similarly, I would worry about Sam Altman and OpenAI if it were simply not possible for anyone anywhere anyhow to make a movie about Sam Altman that he didn't like. And I don't think that's the case. I think, in fact, Luca Guadagnino, I will never pronounce this correctly.
Luca Guadagnino.
I've got a pronunciation guide sitting in front of me and I'm still not going to pronounce it correctly. I would worry if it were simply impossible, and especially if it were legally impossible, to get funding for a movie about Sam Altman, because Sam Altman somehow or another had a no button on this. And it seems like that's not the case. It's not only not the case that it would be impossible for someone to get that funding, it's the case that somebody got that funding. And yes, that movie is not going to be released by Amazon, but it's probably going to end up being released somewhere. Probably. And I'll be a little more concerned if it truly gets buried. But even then, we're not in a world where you can't complain about Sam Altman, or where you can't make a movie about him, or you can't write a novel about him. And that's the one, that's where I become concerned, because that's the thing that bothers me, and that's what government can do. Government can say, no one can say this.
I just, to summarize here, Peter's argument, and I think this is fair, is that if the government were to ban you from doing this, to suppress that speech, that would obviously be bad. I think we all agree with that. But it would be fine to have corporations en masse essentially make this thing disappear, because you can write it down on papers and nail it to a church door. It'll be fine. People can see it that way. I'm being sarcastic. It doesn't matter, strictly speaking, here, because I do think this is going to get out there. I do think this is going to get out there, but I don't think we should be entirely dismissive of the ability of trillion-dollar companies to make things go away via either buying up resources and shutting them down, or by burying them in the algorithm or whatever. I don't, like, it's neither. I don't think we should be totally dismissive of corporate power to stifle speech, even through legal means, and not by sending men with guns to your home to shut it down. That said, I don't think that's really the case here. I think I'm guessing this ends up with someone else.
Yeah, no, and I'm not. I'm not incredibly worried about it in this case here, but I guess I would be keeping an eye on this situation to see whether, for example, like the fear of litigation of the kind that X has employed, for example, with
or
like
Peter
a
Thiel.
Lot of venues. Yeah. Whether that ends up becoming deterrent to people making these kinds of things and releasing these kinds of things. I don't know.
We published some stuff that was like somewhat critical of that lawsuit and sympathetic to Nick Denton's case in the Gawker lawsuit.
See, I was totally on Peter Thiel's side on that one. Fuck Gawker.
All right. What do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Amazon MGM, the parent company of which has invested some $50 billion in OpenAI, is killing a movie critical of the head of OpenAI? Alyssa?
I think we're, you know, sort of getting to a point where it's like controversial that Amazon's in the movie business. Like, I sort of wish they would let someone else do that and go back to selling like web services and toilet paper and, you know, developing factory robots or whatever. Just like, I don't want them in this space. It annoys me. I don't think they really want to be in it either.
Peter.
I mean, it's a little bit controversial in the sense that it's always a controversy when a notable movie gets pulled from its expected release. But I just don't think it's that controversial that a large company would not want to be behind in releasing under its banner. I mean, it funded, but not want to be behind a movie that is going to be perceived as being critical of a major business partner.
Yeah, that's why it's entirely a controversy. And Alyssa's right. At a certain point, Amazon has to decide what sort of business it's in. And if it's
in all the businesses,
you can make movies that are designed to sell things and don't have necessarily a political or social valence, or do have a political and social valence, but have a different sort of political and social valence. But if you're going to be, I don't know what sort of filmmakers are going to want to work for that business. I don't know. But yeah, definitely, it's very obviously a controversy. All right. Make sure to swing by movieisle.substack.com on Thursday for a bonus episode on Toy Story 3 and the great animated features of the 21st century. Speaking of Toy Story movies, on to the main event.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Toy Story 5, the fifth entry in Pixar's flagship franchise, picks up more or less where the fourth one left off. Buzz and Jesse and most of the gang are still with Bonnie, who is the little girl to whom the toys were given at the end of the third entry in the series, while Woody, Cowboy Woody, is living the life of a lost toy. He's rescuing other lost toys who have been abandoned as their kids have turned to screens. That's right, screens, like Kindle Fires, for instance, are the big bad this time around in the form of Lilypad, a sort of baby's first iPad that dominates the attention of Bonnie, the girls in her dance troupe, and every other kid on the block. When the toys look upon the world, they see kids neglecting their playthings and being absorbed by their screens, spending all their time locked in on whatever's happening online. Is Bonnie too old to play with toys, or does she just need to find a friend who is more her speed, more open to using her imagination? Can her faithful playmates help her grow up in a world that is ever more virtual? It's worth noting, I think, that this movie does not treat Lilypad as a pure villain, as not a mustache twirling iPad or whatever, right? She wants to help Bonnie just as much as the other toys in her room. And she thinks that socialization via screens is the best way to do it. And it should be noted that we see everyone in this movie glued to their screens. Parents are just as screen addicted as the kids. Even then, though, the problem is not the screens themselves, right? The problem is other people. It's the girls who torment Bonnie when they find out that she plays with dolls. That's the real problem. It's not the technology. People. People are the problem. It's a message I resonate with quite fondly. Anyway, the technology from in this movie, the technology, which I can describe as there's a thing that's like baby's first GPS. And I kept thinking to myself during this movie, why would a 3-year-old need a GPS tracker? What is the purpose of this toy? That's neither here nor there. There's also a fleet of next gen Buzz Lightyears that double as drones and Wi-Fi hotspots. The technology is more or less value neutral. It's not they're not making a judgment about technology, as one might expect from the company Pixar. Which began as a, you know, more or less Apple product and is now a Disney thing. Most people consume their stuff via Disney. Anyway, the toys are stand-ins for parents. And I think that's more or less common wisdom by now, right? They see their job as readying the kids for adulthood and getting them acclimated to dealing both with the world and with other people. As I noted in my review, the broader question the series asks, really, has been asking, will continue to ask until I am like buying virtual reality dolls for my grandkids and headsets for them to manipulate them with, is this. What is the point of play? What is the goal? Is it to develop a fully realized inner life, one driven by imagination? To learn the proper way to socialize with strangers, to make friends, to cultivate empathy for those around us? All of the above. The big question for the tablet generation is this: does absorption within screens wind up short-circuiting some, or perhaps all, of those efforts? Peter, does Toy Story 5 effectively make the case for toys?
Well, that's a good question. Does it make the case for toys?
Thank you.
I hadn't thought about that.
I mentioned this because you had mentioned something to us about Masters of the Universe. And the way that movie kind of thinks about toys, and relationships.
Yeah, that's right. So, while watching this movie, I was reminded of our conversation about Masters of the Universe, because my view of Masters of the Universe was that it fundamentally misunderstood the appeal of its property. And that appeal was the sort of mega genre, sort of cross genre sandbox of toy play, especially for boys, where dinosaurs and Conan the Barbarian and aliens and spaceships and like Star Wars type things could all exist in the same universe. And He-Man, the movie, Master of the Universe, just didn't capture that sense of fun and play. And part of what is great about this movie, or what I like about it, is that it actually gets at that exact idea in these fantasy play sequences that feature all of these toys put together in an imaginative child's scenario, say a wedding that might turn into a murder mystery or a spy thriller instantly, because again, even the narrative part of the genres are not fixed or stable in these things. It's not just that dinosaurs and toy cowboys can coexist. It's along with this, the spaceman toy. It's that all of these sort of story types, when you're 8 years old, they're not fixed and they can kind of blend and bleed into each other. And I thought that this movie did a very good job of capturing the appeal. Your question was, does it make the case for toys? To me, it made the case for play, and toys can be part of that. But this is a movie that really is making the case for a kind of childlike imaginative play. And it is suggesting, I think not even entirely unreasonably, that screens and screen life aren't like that. They don't facilitate that kind of play nearly as well, because to some degree or another, screens inherently kind of lock you into the universe. Even if it's I love video games. I've played a lot of them, especially even more so as an adult than as a kid. But like those games, even if they are quite sprawling, quite complicated, there is always some sort of limitation that is put there by the game designers. We're going to table the fact that some games can be kind of infinitely modded, but to some degree or another, if you're playing the game, especially the off-the-shelf version of the game, not the one that you've written your own code for, you're playing a game that is entirely designed and kind of managed by somebody else to some degree or another. Now, maybe there's some play within that, certainly in a big open world game like Skyrim. But the point is, this movie gets at that kind of sprawling, limitless, ruleless, unboundedness of childhood fantasy play much better than a movie based on a franchise, an IP that was built around that idea 40 years ago. And so I really liked that aspect of this. And overall, I've thought that this was a good movie, but not a great one. It certainly is not at the level of the first three Toy Story 4 films. And I actually think it's not as good as the last one either. I like Toy Story 4 much more than a lot of people did. And I think what this movie does somewhat less well than the previous Toy Story films is it is a little more frantic. It is a little faster paced and sort of more hectic, jokey in that modern way. This is not a DreamWorks film. It's not a Shrek movie, you know, full of needle drops. I'm not saying it goes that far. It's not annoying and grating, but it has just a little bit more of that kind of, we need to hold your attention because otherwise you might end up looking at your phone kind of frantic energy throughout that I didn't love all the time, even though it is kind of funny. I mean, it's quite funny. So many of those jokes land, but you go back to that first Toy Story film, and sure, there are big chase scenes. And really, like a piece I wrote about a decade ago that I will stand by is that Pixar is kind of secretly some of the best action movies of the last 30 years, right? It's even in, you know, like the
Brad
Finding
Bird,
Dory or whatever, right? Yeah, it's Brad Bird, the most obvious.
Yeah.
But even in things you don't think of as like, what's the Finding Dory sequel? Yeah, right? Up. Yeah. But I wrote this around the Finding Dory sequel, and there's that incredible sequence like in one of the little aquariums where everything's gigantic and they're like, right? And it's like a monster movie, except it's totally acceptable for 6-year-olds, right? Gets at all the excitement and all the tension, and they're showing you action scenes can be and do anything. In any case, I think it's a good movie. It's well made. It's professional. It's enjoyable and funny. And I think stuff will work for adults and for kids. But this movie loses some of that sort of quiet, contemplative nature that the first Toy Story in particular really had. And I don't know whether that's because they feel like they have to compete with the screens that they're kind of criticizing here, or whether it's just, you know, Pixar's changed. There's different people at the top and the world is a different place. And they themselves now have a little bit of frantic brain like we all do.
Yeah, Alyssa, I'll be honest. I don't think this is as good as the first three. I think it's a little better than the fourth. But it definitely feels like it's not that the series has run out of things to say. It's just that it hit a natural endpoint and is now kind of like recursively, oh, look, we got to get the gang back together.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And there's sort of two things that I've been thinking about with this movie, one of which kind of follows on our earlier discussion, the second of which I wanted to ask both of you about. And the first is that I think the movie is a little gutless about screens because it addresses them as hardware, but not as software, right? Like it does not have sort of a willingness to engage with the human intelligence and business imperatives behind the devices themselves, right? And it's like, to a certain extent, like they're closed-ended. They're like the games that Bonnie plays with her friends on the tablet are like Turtle Tag is not actually tag. It is bounded as game. It's physically still. But like, yeah, I mean, you may notice with the lily pad that like there are no like in-app purchases. There are no sort of attempts to get you to upgrade. There is not a sense, and look, like we know from sort of lawsuits and documentation, like, you know, Meta was like sending recruiters to high schools to try and keep kids on apps. Like there, you know, there is like the infinite scroll is a business and design decision. And there's just no engagement with that in this movie at all. Right. Like there's just none.
I'm totally with you on that. I have taken to referring to phones as little addiction boxes for a reason, because they are designed to, and to be fair to the movie, I do think it shows the kind of zone out scroll face, right?
Right.
Without actually like getting into why that happens or what it means.
Yeah. And also like what it means for like what it means developmentally for kids to be physically still, right? Like for boys in particular, I think that's like boys need to be physically active. Like, and it's also just good for kids whose bodies are developing to like run around a lot. It, you know, it addresses a trade-off with play, but not with reading, for example. And if there's like, I mean, I think that toys are very, I think like toys and play are very important. But like, if I've done one thing right as a parent, it's raising an 8-year-old who, where like our biggest disciplinary issues with her right now are like, you have to stop reading and come to the table and being a human being, right? Like she was in the middle of a Harry Potter book the other day and was like, don't bother me, Mom. I'm in another world, right? Like, okay, I'm done. I'm good. And Peter knows my daughter quite well and so can absolutely picture her saying that. But yeah, there's just not a discussion of the sort of the full set of trade-offs, the financial imperatives behind them, and the fact that there's sort of like human intelligence involved in like getting everyone in that brain-numbed state, right? It is engaged with the sort of social questions of how people behave on these apps and whether the connection that's fostered through technology is actually genuine, if it's not sort of played out in the real world. But, you know, as with Amazon kind of not being able to be in the business and making an OpenAI movie, of course Disney and Pixar can't make a movie that's like, actually, like the addiction machines are not just like addiction machines by accident, they're addiction machines by design, right? And like, there is just a level of reckoning that a movie like this is just never going to be able to make.
Just a question on that is, mm-hmm. I mean, Sunny said this movie is smart enough to not make the kind of iPad stand-in, just fully mustache-twirling villain. And I go back and forth on that, actually, like, as I've been thinking about this. But I was just going to, like, it's not clear. I think there might actually be a better movie in which it really is just the bad guy. But I don't, do you agree with Sunny on this? I'm very muddled thinking. And I wonder, do you think there would be a better movie if this just committed, forget the kind of corporate implications, but right, like if this movie committed to the iPad is bad, which you can totally make a case for that, especially for little kids.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think like a social critique, like what if you can't get to the, like the sort of design element in it, like it sort of doesn't matter either way. You know, I mean, I think it like in a weird way, it gets to like the movie is kind of an expression of like a talking point that some influencers have been promoting, which is that like, actually, like tech is really important for social connection, right? Like, you know, Lilypad is ultimately very important in like connecting Bonnie and whatever the other Blaze. So I don't know. These movies don't tend to have pure villains, except maybe for like Sid, the poor, like obviously troubled kid from the first movie who's like doing weird shit to his toys. So I don't know. I'm not sure about that question. Can I turn back and ask you to mine, though, which is that one thing I find very interesting about this franchise is that it's gone from being about boys to being about girls. And that's sort of gone. That is the direction that a lot of pop culture has kind of traveled in, right? Like there have not been like boy heroes in Disney movies for a while. The romance plot has disappeared. And I do think, again, as the mother of an 8-year-old girl, like there are some things this movie gets really right. Like I had not necessarily been prepared by it for how complicated little girls' social dynamics get, even in like first or second grade. Had not quite been prepared for like kind of the arrival of social pressures on the scene. And I should say, like, if any of the parents of my daughter's friends happening to be listening, your girls are wonderful. Everything's largely good. All is well. Like, please, you know, we can still have play dates. I'm not quietly judging you. But I do think it's kind of like, it's interesting that it captures those dynamics pretty well. I do think girls at 8 are like definitely more oriented towards, like they are tweens earlier than boys are in some ways. But I kind of like this. It would have been interesting to have a movie about like where little boys are right now and like what is it like to be on the cusp of like tweendom if you are a little boy. I feel like I have less insight into that. And like, boys and a lot of men are like obviously facing just a lot of challenges right now. Like, does Toy Story lose something by moving away from boys? I don't know. I'd be curious to know what you both think.
I have an almost 8-year-old boy, so I feel relatively qualified to answer this in the sense that, like, the dynamics he has with his friends are different than the dynamics my daughter has with her friends, and it is much more physical still. But it's hard to say whether this is a function of living in Texas or whatever. But like, the kids are just out there like playing sports all the time. They're in a bunch of different. My son in particular is in like a bunch of different sports leagues. He's out there playing, you know, basketball, soccer, football, whatever the season is. So like, it's a little bit different. It did not jump out to me as like particularly bad or annoying that the focus has shifted.
Yeah, I don't think it's like terrible or anything. It was striking to me. It's like we begin with Andy, we end with Bonnie, and yet the sort of public discourse around boys has become more sort of anxious. And this is sort of the rare franchise that once upon a time was like thinking about boys' dynamics and stuff.
Ever really thinking about boys' dynamics, though? I mean, Andy has always been kind of a solitary figure. It's always been about the toys' interactions with this movie is about toys are parents, and the movie is about how parents interact with each other in order to raise their children, really. Like, that is what the series is about. And I think that's still the case. Frankly, this movie does more with interpersonal dynamics with children than any of the other any of the other series, and that's because it kind of has to, because that is the real problem with screens, right? The problem with screens is, yes, the kids get zombified and zonked out in front of a screen. That's a problem, but the real problem is bullying. The real problem is making doing it in a way that is invisible to parents. Right. Like, that's the other thing that this movie kind of gets really right, is that the other toys can't see what's happening really to Bonnie until it happens, I guess.
Well, also, this movie made me very angry at Bonnie's parents. Right. Like, you have this like sweet, weird kid. Like, does she go to school? Are you arranging play dates for her? Like, OK, she goes to some dance class with these. But like, she's going to her first sleepover. Like, you don't have a call with the parents about like what the vibe is going to be like. You're not checking what she's like saying. Like, my kids do not have their own devices. Like, we intend to hold off on that as long as possible. We did get them a tin can phone, which is like a dumb landline. It's hilarious and very sweet. But like, when my kids get devices, they will be handing those devices over to me to get charged every night, like if they want them to have juice. And like, I will be checking them. She's an 8-year-old. Like, I mean, okay, like maybe when kids are 13 or 15 or whatever, like privacy concerns or whatever. Bonnie is 8. These parents suck. Like, they are, like, they're weirdly...
So judgmental. Judging.
Judgmental, right? Like, if you take your lonely child, your lonely, creative, lovely child, and they're like, we'll buy her an iPad. That will make her friends. And then, like, don't see if it's working. Like, I'm sorry. I'm judging you.
I do think there was a line in which after she's initially invited to the sleepover, the parents were like, we got to call the other parents or something. And this is like a really brief, if I recall correctly, there was like, we got to check with her parents, but it'll be okay. We just have to check with them or something like that. But I mean, to focus on the parents and their protective systems or impulses would be to take the focus off the toys, who are our surrogate parents here. And, you know, this is, I think, actually one of the issues with this movie is that these have been at their best stories about the toys and the toy world. And here, this is the Toy Story movie that is least about the toys. The toys are there to serve the human characters, the kids most of all, but in some ways, even the parents, to kind of act as, I don't know, surrogates when the parents aren't around. It's not literalized, but it's there implicitly. And these are Toy Story movies, not kid story movies. And I think that's one of the reasons why, again, this is a well-made movie, but I do think it doesn't work quite as well because it is splitting its time between all these sort of different layers of the family unit in which the toys are there as parents when the parents aren't around, but also the parents are there and you want to know something about them. But this is, you know, this is a 100-minute movie, and it smartly did not make this a 2-hour and 15-minute movie for kids.
Yeah. It's the movie is also just sort of poking uneasily around the edges of sort of what it means for toys to be real, right? You know, in the sort of like the vignettes with the army of Buzz Lightyears, which is actually like pretty funny, you see this family that's going camping, and at first they're all sort of glued to their phones that they're using for flashlights and GPS. But then, like in the tent, the mom is reading The Kids of the Velveteen Rabbit, right? And for any of you who have not been lucky enough to read The Velveteen Rabbit, that's a story about human life is a rich tapestry of experience. Not everyone has, you know, had the childhood all of us had. But The Velveteen Rabbit is a story about, you know, how it's from a toy's perspective, and it's about how if a child loves you enough, like, you'll become real, right? And so you have this, like, raggedy Velveteen Rabbit that sort of functionally saves the life of the child who loves him, but, like, you know, goes on to become a real bunny. And the toys in Toy Story have always been alive. But there is some interesting, there are just like some interesting and unresolved things about the ways in which they might exist sort of independent of their owners, right? Like, Buzz, you know, Woody is literally like running around as like a middle-aged Clint Eastwood man with no name, like in the forest helping lost toys, like sort of reacclimate to life without the reference of their owners. And, you know, Jessie's trauma is kind of resolved when she discovers that the girl she thought abandoned her, in fact, like, named her daughter after Jessie, right? Like, Jessie has sort of become real in an entirely different way. And, you know, that there's just, like, there's something going on there that isn't really fleshed out or developed, but that is kind of interesting.
I got a nit to pick with this movie. In the platoon, with the scenes where we see all of the Buzz Lightyears running around, right? They immediately go limp whenever a human shows up, and they're like, "Oh, this must be part of our, you know, mission program. We have to avoid the humans, right?" Okay, fine. If that's how toys worked, great. Except that's not how they worked in any of the other movies. They have to choose to be still and silent, and sometimes they interact with the world, as when they give Sid a mental breakdown. In the first one. So some inconsistencies there. Inconsistencies. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Toy Story 5, Alyssa?
Thumbs up despite some imperfections.
Thumbs up, though. It's my least favorite of the franchise.
Yeah, thumbs up. It's fine. It's definitely like 1, 2, and 3 are pretty great movies, and 4 and 5 are kind of like, this series continues. It keeps going. Can't stop Toy Story. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.